Jeremy Corbyn's leadership campaign has helped fuel discussion about politicians' relationships with voters. Well, tonight's Archive on 4 explores the life not of a Labour but of a Conservative MP who believes strongly in engaging the public more directly in politics. Rory Stewart was elected in 2010. He stood out from the crowd. He'd walked across Asia, helped to govern parts of southern Iraq during the war, and worked at Harvard. So how has he adjusted to life as MP for Penrith and the border?
The dream of Britons is a place like Cumbria. Our culture, our kindness, our common sense, our compassion. It's our character as a people which makes our tourism so special. So thank you very much indeed. I'm Rory Stewart and I've been MP for Penrith and the Border since 2010. For the last year, I've been keeping an audio diary of my work in the constituency and in Westminster. And the reason for this is simple. Politics in Britain is going through a very challenging time. We need to find ways of re-engaging the public in what politics is about. And perhaps one way to start is for MPs to communicate better about what they do. So, for example, I'm here today at an event marking the beginning of English Tourism Week in Cumbria.
Nice to meet you. I'm Amy. I'm a landlady.
Sorry, it's all a bit...
Oh, no, it's fine, it's fine.
My name is Charlie Thornton. I am involved with this English Tourism Week event, which is taking place here at the Midland Hotel Appleby. MPs are crucial to raising the profile of tourism at a national scale. It's very important that MPs know all there is to know about tourism in their constituency, and events such as this allow him to do just that.
So we're just going to do a quick tour of the pub. I'll just tell you a little bit about it. We bought the building in October 2010.
How many rooms?
We've got 5 ensuite rooms.
If I went on TripAdvisor, would I find you?
Yes, we're on TripAdvisor as a restaurant and as a hotel, so right. We're on there twice. Would you all like to have a look upstairs and I'll show you what we've done?
My name is Giles Brown. I work for the Eden Brewery, which is based near Penrith. For a local MP, lots of people are looking for them to be accessible and to have a genuine interest in what's going on locally and not just show their face in a kind of PR way, but genuinely interested in you come and get involved in local events like this.
For those of you who haven't seen Clive and Amy, I'm going to embarrass them by making them step forward, but those of you who don't see, this is Clive and Amy, whose amazing pub and hotel this is. We've just had a tour around upstairs. It's very important to understand just how important pubs and hotels are to our economic life. And in the end, one of the things I notice when I go to Dubai, and there are 130,000 British citizens living in Dubai, or you go to China, or you meet British soldiers on the front line in Iraq or Cyprus, when they think of Britain, they think, really, of an area like this. That's been a really valuable meeting, partly because at the very end of the meeting I found a group of people who are actually quite angry with the government. They're a group who are organising walking tours. They were very angry about the lack of provision of bus services. We talked about the fact that the Seddle Carlisle line, which we're looking at here, was about to be closed and the community fought to keep it open. So in that case the government was wrong and the community was right. And we found ourselves being dragged into discussions about the constitution, about community action, about financing, about decision making. That's what I love. I mean, that's what politics is about, because I was dealing there with some very bright, young, retired people with very different political views to me who want a chance to argue. And I like that. I like the passion of that.
My name is Felix Martin. I am an economist and I've known Rory for a long time because we first met when we were 10 or something. And then we were also at university together and we've been firm friends ever since. In the UK at the moment, we are having a period of soul searching about our politics and how it operates. And if I think of a lot of people of my generation, for example, who have become politicians, a lot of them are those who went almost directly from university into politics. But Rory is certainly not that. And I think he brings some interesting insights, having been in political roles in very different contexts.
Friday, 22nd of August. Rory is driving between meetings in his constituency. Penrith and the Border is the largest constituency in the country, so there are often long distances to cover.
I think politics can be very different to what it is. I just think it's going to be tough getting there. But I think the public is dreaming politicians who are more open and who engage more directly with the public.
I'm Caroline Crampton, the web editor at the New Statesman magazine. Rory Stewart's route into politics hasn't been very typical at all, particularly for his time of entering politics in 2010. There are no others who have been in the army, worked in the diplomatic service, walked all around Iraq and Afghanistan, written books, presented television programmes. It's very unusual. It's far more typical for a New Age conservative to have been a special advisor, worked in PR, so have worked in the Westminster sphere their whole lives and then been elected.
Friday, 22nd of August. Rory is getting ready to judge a Cumbrian art competition.
And I'm halfway through a Friday constituency day. So I've just come from meeting the fire union, and I've just been looking at fire appliances, fire engines, talking about fire pension schemes, looking at how you cut people out of road traffic collisions, looking at the number of house fires. And now I'm going into a completely different thing, which is the Cumbrian Artist of the Year competition, where I'm going to be looking at visual art before I go on to the surgery. Hello.
Hi, I'm Mark.
Hi, Mark. Great to see you. Talk me through who everybody is. You're the arts manager.
That's right. So I run the gallery here at Reges and program our exhibitions.
Great.
Hello, my name is Mandy Nicholson. I'm the artist founder director of ArtGene in Barry and Furness.
So we had a busy day. We've just whittled down about 150 artworks. So I think we've probably got about between 40 and 50 here.
And we've shortlisted five artists whose work is very strong and gives a positive read of the work that's going on in Cumbria today.
So here we are looking at the shortlist, and the shortlist is taking us from photographs through what seems to be abstract art, conceptual art, sort of almost photorealist painting. People often ask me why I wanted to become an MP, and that's partly because I'd spent a lot of my life working outside the United Kingdom. I'd worked in Iraq, I'd run a charity in Afghanistan, I'd been at Harvard University. And if I had wanted to remain focused on international affairs, then I probably would have worked for the UN or for an NGO or maybe continued as an academic. But since what really mattered to me was this particular 60 million people living in this particular island, it seemed to me the very best way I could work was to become a Member of Parliament. And by chance, my very first 5 years as a Member of Parliament corresponded with a fundamental challenge to the complete makeup of the United Kingdom.
September 2014. Scotland is getting ready to vote on whether to leave the United Kingdom.
Scotland will vote to stay or quit the United Kingdom on September the 18th. The campaign north of the border...
Of course we can use the pound, we could use the ruble, we could use the dollar, we could use the yen.
We can use anything we want. The problem is...
The question of immense magnitude for the whole UK and its place in the world, and the way it sees itself, the way it imagines itself.
Are we divided nation against nation, or are we unified by culture and language? And there is only one answer to that question. It cannot be simply economics. It was probably the greatest thing in my whole time in politics. The thing that's mattered more to me than anything else was keeping the United Kingdom together. The nature of that love which we express for Scotland, we in this house are struggling to express. We're not very good as politicians in talking about emotions. We've become very bad at it. But we need to learn to do it.
I'm Isabel Hardman, the assistant editor at The Spectator. Rory is a passionate unionist. He was one of the MPs who actually appeared genuinely anxious and emotional at the idea of Scotland leaving, not resorting to pragmatic arguments about currency union. Made a mound, a cairn, really, of decorated stones, which was designed to show a feeling of mutual appreciation between all the different parts of the United Kingdom.
Spring 2014. Rory Stewart presents Border Country, the story of Britain's lost middle land on BBC Two. He explores the region stretching along the English-Scottish border, where his own constituency lies.
We've become very used to the border that divides England and Scotland. But there's another land buried beneath this border. Neither England nor Scotland, but what I call the Middle Land. stretching from the Humber in the south to the Firth of Forth in the north. It's an area of natural geographic unity. The unique climate and landscape of the Pennines and the Lake District blends seamlessly. The Scottish Cheviots and the Pentland Hills. I'm a Scot, but I now live in Cumbria, 35 miles south of the boundary between England and Scotland, where I'm the Member of Parliament for Penrith and the Border.
We're continuing a very, very long tradition here, back over five generations.
I am surrounded by a Middleland culture.
Many congratulations, Rogan.
Customs and traditions that can be found nowhere else in Britain.
There are MPs who grew up in their communities and in their constituencies and therefore already know a lot about how their constituents live and so on. And Rory would be the first to admit that he didn't, of course, grow up in that constituency. And I think that's part of the reason why things are so important to spend as much time and effort as possible to really get to know his constituents.
December 2014, Rory has spent the week on a fact-finding mission in Iraq with members of the Defence Select Committee. And now he's back up in Cumbria for the weekend.
So this is my constituency weekend, and I try to get up to the constituency every week. We're now a Saturday in mid-December.
Rory is running a surgery session at the Conservative Club in Brampton. A farmer wants to get Rory's advice on an inheritance dispute he's finding hard to resolve.
One of the things that's quite striking is that people are coming in to see me who've already reached the end of their tether. They feel they've been failed by the system, they've been failed by government, they've been harassed by their neighbours, they've been let down by their lawyers. Their lives can feel as though they're fraying and coming to pieces. You can see people deeply stressed. You can see that they're beginning to get ill. That was a man who's been for 50 years a farmer and a healthy outdoor life, and who now is looking pale, who's clearly his health is suffering, stress is beginning to tell, and really the role there of a Member of Parliament feels less like a legislator and almost more like a councillor or even perhaps the traditional role of a priest. You're there to try to provide some compassion, if you can, some common sense, but it's a very uncertain informal relationship with people, often at a time of immense stress in their lives.
Saturday 13th of December. Rory's heading on to a coffee morning at Bewcastle Primary School in a remote part of the constituency.
We're driving up towards the very tip of the English-Scottish border, and this territory is known as the Bewcastle Wastes. We've just crossed the line of Hadrian's Wall, and we're in a territory between Hadrian's Wall and the English-Scottish border. It's a landscape not really of villages. This place, Walton, is the last village we'll pass through. From now onwards, it's isolated farmhouses. And I'm quite unashamed about thinking that we should provide support for these communities, for these farmers. I'm not, in this regard, a kind of radical free market people. I don't believe a sort of brutal sink or swim attitude. I think we have a particular obligation towards communities like this and to preserving them. Today I'm going to be visiting the local primary school that's struggling to survive because it's got only just over 20 children. This is Georgina, who's the head teacher of the school.
It's a much needed resource for everybody who's here because we're 35 minutes away from Carlisle and some of our children come on the bus even 20, 25 minutes to get here. Lots of children who are here, their parents and grandparents came here, and it's very historic.
If you look around you, you can see that a lot of people are related to each other. So Duncan, who's sitting there with a big tattoo on his arm, is the second cousin of Barbara Smith, who's chair of the parish council.
We've been here quite a while, and once again, Barbara will tell you how long we've gone back.
I don't know, but my grandmother was at Telford. Duncan's grandfather was our youngest brother, that's right. Yes. But our families go back right to the 1600s. Yes. So, I mean, there's no... problem with Lewis not having roots, but we certainly have.
I'm still an incomer. I've only been here 22 years. It's vital that we keep the school going. There is nothing else. We have no pub. We have no pub in the parish at all. We have no shop. We have no post office.
All those things once existed have been lost since the Second World War.
Absolutely.
You go through Kinkley Hill, you can see what used to be the shop, what used to be the post office.
Three pubs in Roadhead and a market, a cattle market, all gone, which is very sad, really.
It's about trying to think creatively about how to keep the energy of the place going. I think you've got to try to be realistic that small farms have always struggled to survive. Somebody like Steve, who's only farming 60 cows, is going to really struggle to compete with people farming 1,000 cows. But the Jameses, for example, the Dodds or the Routledges, are combining their work now with some agricultural contracting, with fencing, with working in the auction mart in Carlisle. If we could try to encourage farmers to provide a bit more in terms of accommodation for people, work out how we can promote the area. There's huge potential in trying to encourage tourism. We can keep this community alive. Maybe in 50 or 100 years' time there'll be a renaissance of small farms and we may be okay.
Caroline Crampton, web editor of The New Statesman.
I was recently interviewing James Rebanks, who is a shepherd in Cumbria, near Penrith, and James is also the author of a book called A Shepherd's Tale, where he's written about the traditional hill farming that his family's been doing for 600 years. And I asked him, how do you feel about your MP? How do you feel about Rory Stewart, given that he's not from round here and he's of a completely different social class and background to you? And James was saying, I was disposed to dislike him, but he comes to all of the livestock shows, he comes to all the sheep shows, and, you know, I appreciate that in my MP. But James really didn't like the comments that Rory had made, that he's now said he regrets, that the relative poverty of some of his rural constituents, and particularly this fact that they hold their trousers up with bale twine. And James was very cross that anyone could make this assumption about him. And his wife Helen piped up and said, James, but you do have your trousers held up with bale twine. And James just went, but that's not the point. It's not for him to say that I do what I do with my trousers. And I think that, for me, really encapsulated the way a lot of the people around there feel about him, in that they appreciate the effort he makes and his interest in them and their way of life, but he will never be of their way of life.
Rory is travelling south from Bucastle to Lanercost. He's going to see a new visitor centre that's providing information about the history of Hadrian's Wall and the border area.
The reason why I want to protect small farms and the living community of rural areas is that it's our last very tenuous, fragile link to the past. The urban world is a swept clean world. And these areas, these rural areas, which still just about touch a past, are being eroded so quickly. Joe, Steve Pattinson's son, who I guess is 11, everything rests on whether he will take over that farm or not. If he suddenly loses interest in cattle as a 15, 16-year-old, that will be another farm gone. And nobody else will come in here too far. It will be bought again as a retirement home for somebody to live in. It's true, I think, for me, that I have quite a strong sense of the past of traditional farming communities. Having spent quite a lot of time living in very rural farming areas in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, and also in rural Nepal and Pakistan and Iran.
He had a very interesting career in the Foreign Office. He was first in Indonesia, then in the Balkans a bit, and that was at a time when Montenegro was still part of a union with Serbia, but was thinking of breaking up, and so it was quite a sort of hot topic, an interesting place to serve. And then he left the Foreign Office and did something which he had talked about doing for a long time, which was this enormous walk across Asia. And that last section of his walk across Asia, the section in Afghanistan, of course, provided the inspiration and material both for his book and for a BBC documentary, The Great Game, on the history of Afghanistan and the history of foreign involvement in Afghanistan.
When I walked across Afghanistan shortly after 9/11, I found a hospitable and attractive country.
but still deeply conservative, isolated and difficult for a foreigner to understand. It made me reflect on the superpowers who have so often invaded the mountains of Afghanistan. How often they get caught up in their own strategic games. How easily they become out of touch, failing to grasp the complexity and resistance of Afghanistan.
When Rory came back from Afghanistan, there was another major foreign policy challenge on the horizon, which nobody who is interested in foreign and defense policy could miss, and that, of course, was Iraq and the aftermath of the Iraq War. And Rory, unsurprisingly, was very keen to get involved there, and he was one of just two or three senior people in first one province and then another province. I think he learned an awful lot about politics and governance in those situations. And in a sense, that was one of the things which got him thinking even more seriously about politics and governance in his own country, the United Kingdom.
Sunday, 14th of December. Rory is getting ready to return to Westminster in time for Monday morning.
Britain, I think, is exciting for a member of parliament because we don't really know where it's going to go. It's at the sort of front edge of history. A country like Afghanistan, its future we hope to be a little bit more like Britain, but what the future of Britain is much less certain. We only have hints followed by guesses. We were the first country to industrialize, the first to deindustrialize, which means trying to envisage that future, trying to envisage who we are is difficult. I had a teacher who came up to me who said, I'm required to teach traditional British values, but I want you to send me a full formal list of what traditional British values are so that I can teach them. And I said, look, I don't think we want to be prescriptive in that way. I think you should have the freedom as a teacher to communicate that in a way that you interpret. And she said, well, I'd much rather be teaching universal values. I'm not interested in traditional British values. Why can't I teach modern universal ethical values? So I said, well, I think one of the challenges is trying to work out how we keep a sense of identity, how we build a sense of nationhood in this country, if we talk only about universal values. You know, what have we really got to hold on to that makes us British? In that conversation were a lot of the tensions, a lot of the challenges that define what it means to be a politician today.
Politics for Rory was a very long-held ambition, but he'd not been a member of the Conservative Party. The opportunity came up for him at the general election of 2010, or just before it, because of the whole expenses scandal and cleansing of the stables by David Cameron in particular, who was a relatively new leader of the Conservative Party at that time, and he decided that there was a lot of the old guard that had to go, and that meant that there was an opportunity which wouldn't otherwise have arisen, because otherwise it's pretty difficult if you turn up without having been a member of a party. Understandably, there are a lot of people ahead of you in the queue. Of course, you know, you have to get selected for a seat. He didn't get some of the early seats that he had applied for, but got Penrith and the border.
Monday, 15th of December. The central lobby in the Houses of Parliament.
The first thing that one feels coming in here for the first time is a sense that it doesn't quite make sense, that it's a sort of Alice in Wonderland world in which you lurch from sometimes feeling that the subjects being discussed are far too important and you feel that you're too small to be discussing them, to suddenly feeling the subjects being discussed are almost irrelevant and nothing quite seems to fit.
You are elected to this incredibly grand building and it's an incredibly exciting time, and obviously your family are very excited and you get a lot of media attention, and suddenly you realise that unless you play your cards right as a backbencher, no one pays you any attention. And that's very frustrating, and you see MPs turning up full of excitement and then the wind gradually disappearing from their sails as they realise really the influence they have. They can write pamphlets, they can hold campaigns, the influence they have is quite small.
Relatively brief remarks is that Russia does pose a very significant and substantial threat to Europe. That argument has been made when Churchill made a speech in the chamber. His entire speech was then reported on the front page of the Times. The galleries were packed, debates went on throughout the night.
Disraeli ran the country from the House of Commons. He spent 8.5 hours a day sitting in that chamber with his dispatches and his dispatch box running the party in the country. Now, even on issues that are immensely important, you find the chamber is surprisingly empty, that there aren't any journalists in the galleries, that people are reading speeches, or we spend too much time on our mobile telephones. It isn't a real debate in the way that I was hoping.
Does the Prime Minister agree with me? Does the Prime Minister agree with me?
There's sometimes a sense of slightly robotic contributions in the chamber. Now, I think the reason is that not many people watch it. So why would you concoct this marvellous speech if it's going to be heard by maybe 30 of your colleagues who've bothered to turn up to the debate? In the long list of things that MPs have to do, and they have to do a great deal, they might not think speech preparation is the most important thing.
But the chamber matters. We are elected members of Parliament. We're not Newsnight commentators. The chamber of the House of Commons exists as the key forum for political and public debate. It's the most direct way of reaching other members of Parliament. It's the most direct way of forcing ministers to listen to quite a lengthy argument, which they wouldn't otherwise listen to. It connects to the way that we can use our votes, the way we can amend legislation. It connects to members who may not be in the chamber, but many of whom are watching it on television or who are reading it in Hansard. It's the prime currency in the end. Even if none of the public are watching debate, even if the journalists aren't watching debate.
The headlines this morning. President Putin says war between Russia and Ukraine is unlikely. There are growing doubts both sides in the conflict will withdraw their heavy weapons from the front line. Sir Malcolm Rifkind is under pressure to resign.
Friday, 20th of December, Westminster. Rory is late to appear on BBC TV show Daily Politics.
So this is almost the daily thing, which is friction between Parliament and Milbank, because Milbank's where all the radio and television studios are. So local news, national news. I've agreed. I'm not quite sure why to go on a programme called Daily Politics, which is a television chat programme. Well, we're joined now by Rory Stewart, the chairman of the House of Commons Defence Select Committee, and Dr. Robin Niblett, the director of international affairs think tank Chatham House. Welcome to both of you. Rory Stewart, is this ceasefire going to hold?
Putin's an opportunist, so I think it depends. So I came out, I was stopped by a Channel 5 television camera. I assumed, probably foolishly, that they were going to be asking me about Russia and Ukraine, and of course what they suddenly started asking me about was Malcolm Rifkind's resignation, which I wasn't prepared for. And I wouldn't have agreed to do that interview normally because it's not a subject I think I've got much very interesting to say about or thoughtful about. But once the camera's rolling, there's not much that you can then do. It's as though somehow radio and television are sort of trying to fill up their programmes and time with politics, but it's not politics as I understand politics. It's very rarely about the fundamental values of our country, about what sort of society we dream of in 30 years' time, about what our principles are.
I suppose journalists and broadcasters are limited by the extent to which the public want to engage in deep philosophical debates about politics.
Isabel Hardman, assistant editor of The Spectator magazine.
But I think where Rory does have a point in terms of the way that politics is covered and perhaps particularly presented on broadcast programmes, and this is the fault of the parties, not the broadcasters, is that you get two representatives from each party to do a discussion on a political programme, and they won't have a debate. They'll both just chunter out the same pre-prepared lines that are somehow designed to appeal to their key electorate. So they won't even really engage with one another about the ideas, which is what Rory wants.
I believe passionately that politicians could engage the public better. A lot of people have become disillusioned with politics. And unless we change this state of affairs, we're failing to make the most of our democracy. We're missing a huge opportunity to harness the energy of people across the country to help shape Britain and its future.
Friday, 20th of February, members of the Cumbria Youth Parliament visit their MPs at Westminster. The meeting's taking place in one of the richly decorated committee rooms in the Houses of Parliament.
Like, we young people, we have to get our voice out because politics is a big part of our life and we should try and get our views across.
In my area, so I'm in South Cumbria, Barrow-in-Furness, I think a big particular issue for us is mental health.
I think mental health is a massive issue. I really feel that services need to be improved.
One of my main issues is West Cumbria Hospital, the closure of major departments there.
Do you think the fact that this is a 150-year-old building with a lot of fake medieval stone and woodwork, is that something that you think matters, doesn't matter, is irrelevant, is relevant? Any thoughts? Let's try to bring in somebody who hasn't spoken so much recently.
The building is a big part of British history. Politicians have met in here for a very long time, and you couldn't change that ever.
I think Parliament, you know, it has an air of dignity about it because of all the things that have taken place here. Coming here from rural Cumbria makes me feel like youth voice is starting to matter more to politicians, where in the past it has been disregarded.
This building's like a symbol of our nation. It's not something that we take lightly. Things we do here affects everybody in our nation. It's not like just one or two people, it's like the whole of everybody who lives here.
Yes, I mean, I hear a lot of people are talking about history, and absolutely, it is a great example of British workmanship, but I think as well, it is the present and it is the future. I mean, let's look at the investment that's going in to ensure that this is here for hundreds and hundreds of years to come.
This has been really important for me personally in terms of rebuilding confidence in this vocation. One of the things that I thought was very, very moving is that people are pointing to the fact that in the end, this is a story about British craftsmanship. It's a story about a parliament that has meaning for the world. The way in which people are reflecting on how history can be a useful thing, I think, is really encouraging. And I think it's enormously important for us as MPs. I think the better MPs feel about themselves and their job, the more they feel that the public actually does care about Parliament, the better I hope we're going to behave as MPs.
Outside the committee room, Rory reflects on his meeting with the Cumbria Youth Parliament.
The most exciting thing for me is just how many ideas are coming out. These people are more articulate, more educated, more focused on politics than probably was the case 30 years ago. What worries me is that within 10 or 15 years' time, the people in this room will just get disillusioned and fed up because we don't have a local democratic structure to allow people to be citizens. We need to totally transform local democracy. We really need to have directly elected mayors at local levels. We need parish councils with responsibility for raising revenue, for administering things. We need some way of tapping the fact that we've got 60 million energized people who should be and who want to play an active role as citizens and aren't being given an opportunity to do that.
Saturday, 7th of March. Rory's in the constituency for a weekend of meetings and events.
Today we have 9 different meetings, and then tomorrow, Sunday, I'll have a lunch, and then I'll get back on the train back down to London to start the week's work in London on Monday morning.
In the village of Low Row, Rory's chairing a meeting about the options for rolling out broadband to small and far-flung communities.
We've got one big fight taking place December, January, which is that the County Council has been slow on spending the money, so I'm trying to put pressure to get another £3 million out of the government. To really get something done, I believe you need to do it morning, noon and night. You need to wake up thinking about it, go to bed thinking about it, totally immerse in it. And the problem with an MP's life is attention deficit disorder, that you're dealing with a different, peculiar issue almost every hour of the day. To really sort out broadband in Cumbria, I would need to have just that for 2 years. I'm doing broadband, I'm running it, I'm in charge, I'm getting on every village, I'm sorting everything, I'm pushing, I'm drawing in more money, etc. That's what I did in Afghanistan running a charity, and that's where I think the most fulfilling type of work comes. And that's what I'd love to be able to do for Cumbria, because actually the problem with this current situation is that one's being distracted, one can't do things as well as one likes.
Isabel Hardman, assistant editor of The Spectator magazine.
I think the pressures on MPs are huge in terms of how much they have to pack into their week. It is very difficult for MPs to juggle that, but I'd say that it's becoming more and more difficult to separate the constituency role and the sort of national, international policy role of an MP. MPs are much more involved in their constituencies than they were 50 years ago, where they might visit once or twice a year. Now they live there, they're there every week, they're doing events all weekend, and they're much more involved in a sort of social worker-style role in the lives of their constituents. Personally, I think that's absolutely right, because it means that they understand the impact of the policies that they are approving in the House of Commons. So that's why those two parts of being an MP are so important and sort of have a symbiotic relationship.
Welcome to the session of the Defence Affairs Committee on the situation in Iraq and Syria, and specifically the threat posed by the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant.
Rory became chair of the Defence Select Committee in May 2014. We were all quite anxious about him taking over because he'd never chaired a committee before. He had a background that was more foreign affairs than defence, but he'd been elected, and actually he grew into the job very quickly.
Madeleine Moon, Labour MP for Bridgend, and member of the Defence Select Committee, which was chaired by Rory between May 2014 and the election in 2015.
What was interesting about Rory is he wanted to look at the wider foreign affairs issues that also backed some of the defence issues. Even before Rory became chair of the Defence Select Committee, he was on the Foreign Affairs Committee, and he was standing up and saying loud and strong the things that he thought the government were doing wrong. And as a backbencher, that's what he should be doing. That's exactly what you need to be doing as a backbencher. It's the great power of the backbencher. You owe nothing to anybody, and you can stand up and say, you're wrong about this, and this is why.
I am, as the chair of the Defence Committee, getting together the last two main reports which we're going to publish. And the Defence Committee works through reports. In other words, we produce these 30, 60-page documents, which inform Parliament and the public of what is going on in the Ministry of Defence. Our job is to hold the Ministry of Defence accountable. And in particular, what we're doing is we're focusing on two things. We're focusing on how decisions are made in the Ministry of Defence, and we're focusing on the future shape of the armed forces over the next 5 to 6 years. But underlying the whole thing, the real push at the moment is for us to try to get the parties to commit to spending 2% of GDP on defence.
Britain is one of only four countries that currently spends 2% of its GDP on defence. We have the second largest defence budget in NATO.
The UK government is committed to a reduction in the level of public spending, which is unparalleled in our own history.
Thank you, Mr. Deputy Speaker. The assumption of spending 2% of GDP on defence, which of course is absolutely essential, because we organise an entire NATO summit around the idea of spending 2% of our GDP on defence, is of course the hope that as the economy grows, defence spending will grow and we can make the necessary...
We are not investing enough in people on the ground. This was very close to Rory's heart because he'd actually been on the ground. He'd been talking to ordinary Iraqis every day when he was working there as a deputy regional governor. We assume we know what's happening in Iraq by talking to government officials in the Green Zone, talking to other Western governments within the Green Zone, and whatever we see from spy planes and drones. We don't get out in the field. We don't have people on the ground in the villages in the way we used to in the past. We had absolutely no understanding of how Iraq was working. We had historical understanding, but we didn't have the latest understanding.
It's Monday 9th of March, and Parliament is soon to be dissolved before the election on 7th of May.
What's very striking as a first-time MP is the sense that an election is coming very soon. You can see things that previously would have passed without notice. My producing a critical Defence Committee report on government policy in Iraq, which 2 years ago people would just accept as being part of my job in Defence Committee, suddenly now gets pulled into an election and people saying, hey, Rory, what are you doing? You're causing problems, causing media stories just 2.5 months before we're going to an election.
it's a dangerous thing to do. So different kinds of pressures begin to emerge. Behaviour changes. In about 3 weeks' time, Parliament will end after the budget and people will begin to go up to their constituencies to get into the final stretch of the campaign. And you can hear now a bell ringing, which is a signal that the chamber is now meeting for prayers. And I'll hear that 3 more times, and then we won't hear that bell again until the middle of May. And it's really a time also for me to look back over the last almost 5 years and work out what on earth I've done with my life. I mean, 5 years is quite a long period of your life, and I've made a decision to stand again. And of course, I'm having to look forward and work out what on earth I'm going to be able to achieve by standing again for another 5 years. 12th November, we were lucky enough to have our first baby, son. And one of the questions I think people ask is whether suddenly having a family reshapes your perspective on being an MP. I now think slightly more than I would before about what the world is going to look like when he is older. I also believe quite strongly that this is a job which has to take priority. I wouldn't want to feel that we suddenly started reshaping all the business of Parliament simply to accommodate the private lives of MPs. I think this is a very unusual, strange job, and it does involve sacrifices, probably should involve sacrifices.
Rory has always said that Britain is not punching above its weight at the moment. If anything, we have slipped back into being happy to just muddle along. I see that on the NATO Parliamentary Assembly where I sit. There's been for some time a frustration that Britain has taken a back seat, that we have decided to almost pull back into austerity being part of our mindset, that we don't aspire to things, we don't want the best, we don't want to represent the best anymore. We want the mediocre because it's cheaper.
I've come from teaching at an American university. I taught at Harvard. I come back to Britain. I'm afraid that if I was really honest in my heart of hearts, we are going to be hard pushed to match Harvard. And that isn't just because of money. It's also about culture. It's about ambition. It's about aspiration. It's about the expectations we set for ourselves, our students. It's about the risks we take. It's about the imagination that a university shows. And I know that's a difficult thing to say because in Britain, people really, really hate being compared to the United States. And people fall over backwards to say, ah, yes, but in the United States, they've got more money, or but in the United States, they're a bigger country. But let me give you an example of what I mean by that. When I was in Afghanistan 2 months ago, and again when I was in Afghanistan 8 months ago, there was a big political crisis. And the heart of that crisis, during a 2-week period, President Obama called the two Afghan candidates 10 times in 2 weeks. Now, you say this to a French or British or German diplomat and they go, oh, America has more resources. Well, what does that mean? What, their phone bill is bigger? I mean, no, it isn't that they have more. It's in that case that they are taking responsibility.
The election campaign is underway after the dissolution of Parliament.
I will be going to all four corners of all four nations in our United Kingdom with one clear message.
This is our plan. Let's build a better country together.
Saturday 25th of April. It's not long until the election, and Rory's campaigning in the town of Kirby Stephen.
It is really difficult. Can you imagine if you were totally blind?
Yeah.
How do you get anywhere?
And your husband doesn't drive?
He drives, but he's not well.
Right.
So I'm dependent.
Right.
Totally dependent. I know people in Kirby, it's on their own. They're totally trapped.
Right.
The town is like closing down because the buses, if the buses go...
Well, there is a bus every day dependent. So you're not totally trapped? People can get...
No, not totally trapped.
Right, right.
But you can only use your bus passes after 9:30 and up to, is it 3:30? Yeah, they're not 24 hours.
Right.
And it's like I went on training to Edinburgh. And the guy I went on training with, he went, ah, mine works 24 hours a day on trains, buses, planes, ferries. I went, what? Everything.
Because he's Scottish.
Yeah. How far from the border are we? 50 miles.
That's right. Well, I mean, unfortunately, you go to a different parliament, you get a different deal, yeah.
But
You can see the disparity, can't you?
But the question is, how do they fund it? People are very interested in the issue of the S&P, but they're interested in the issue of the S&P in different ways. For some of them, it's that they believe in Britain, and a lot of them join me in building this enormous cairn on the English-Scottish border in order to show that they believe in Britishness and they don't want independence. But there are other people, and Jean's an example, who are angry that they feel that Scots are getting a better deal than the English. They can't understand why, in her case, grants for old people travelling on transport is more generous in Scotland than it is in England. And people are aware that you get free prescription charges on the other side of the border.
And for William Stephen Ian Whitelaw,
Conservative,
26,433.
The constituency traditionally was a very, very contested area between the Liberals and the Conservatives. It's been Conservative since the late 50s, but the next door seat is a very strong Liberal seat. And the reason I think it stayed Conservative has partly been because Willie Whitelaw, who was the MP in the 60s and 70s, worked very hard, lived in the constituency, loved the constituency. His successor, David McLean, lived here, loved it, worked it hard. So it hasn't been a sort of safe seat in the sense in which you get the impression that maybe some London suburbs are safe Conservative seats. It's been a seat that has always expected its members to work hard, be here a lot, be very visible.
Welcome to the Spin Zone. We're backstage at this week's BBC general election debate. This is where the politicians and the journalists meet. Everyone's got one eye on the big screen and another on, yes, Twitter. Monitoring social media.
When people are talking about how to win an election, people tend to think in terms of party messaging, keeping it simple, repeating the same phrase. Of course, what I experience here, and my colleague, in fact, who's a Lib Dem in Westmorland and Lonsdale, I think, experiences too, is that actually winning a seat can also be immensely about human connections that don't need to depend on a particular party line or a particular party discipline in quite the way that the election managers sometimes seem to suggest.
Rory had this plan, for example, to walk from village to village in his constituency campaigning, and partly because he finds the modern mode of interaction between MPs and their constituents to be a bit uninspiring. He certainly loves meeting constituents face-to-face as much as possible.
I spent the first week of the campaign walking, so I came down through Penrith, down to Askham, through Ulswater, up to Skelton, which was great. I mean, I met people in the streets, people walked alongside me, I was able to work my way through villages. I would have liked to walk the whole thing, but I've had to recognise, with a relatively short campaign, that to cover 1,200 square miles, I have to get in a car.
Saturday, 25th of April. Rory is taking part in the hustings at the United Reformed Church, Penrith.
This is it's a very good question, because it's a very controversial question. It's one that most of us in this room have been debating for a very long time. It's true, it's absolutely true, that we need to think very hard about this. The world changes, we need to reconsider these kinds of things. I think politics would work better if we were liberated more to be ourselves in our constituency. I love the fact that a lot of these hustings I'm doing during this campaign over the last 4 weeks have been me in rooms of 100 people, 150 people, or even 20 people. Actually, in Wigton, even 5 people, where I can actually really argue person to person for an hour and a half.
7th of May, election day.
Good morning and welcome to BBC News. Voters are heading to the polls after weeks of election campaigning. Polling stations at schools, parishes.
It's 3:30 in the afternoon, and it's the day of the election, and I've spent the day going around my constituency, starting at 7 in the morning. So I began down in the south at Shap, which is the very southernmost end of my constituency, was then up in Brampton, which is up in the northeastern end, and of course the largest, most sparsely populated in England. And now I've popped into Carlisle. And I'm in Carlisle because John Stevenson, who's my colleague here, has a very, very marginal seat. He holds it by only about 800 votes. It's one of the great target seats. In fact, the Prime Minister was here last night trying to convince people to do the last push voting for John Stevenson. So it's very important that we knock up. So I brought up my whole team for Penrith and the Border. My wife's with me, and we've just spent the last hour and a half going door to door, knocking up people who are registered as Conservative voters, but who we so far don't have a record of having voted. And it's just to make sure that nobody forgets to vote. The turnout is going to be absolutely essential. I'm going to start by looking at number 69 here, which is behind this huge hedge. These are very kind of pretty gardens, a lot of cherry trees in bloom, a lot of shocking kind of knicker pink cherry trees. And I'm going to knock on the door of number 69. Oh, hello there, ma'am.
Hello.
Sorry.
We voted for John.
Well done. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Have a good day. Thank you. Polling day elections, of course, that I really remember are strangely not in Britain. They're in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. So I was there in Iraq for the first elections after Saddam had fallen, where people were obviously threatening the polling stations with bombs. And it was amazing both to see young Iraqis and civil society outside the polling stations protecting it, the pride that people were taking in voting, the enormous turnouts, 90% of people voting, and the very unexpected results, which were going to determine the future of Iraq. So I suppose when I think about polling, it's those very intense experiences, compared to which, of course, this feels much more like a ritual or a tradition or a festival. It doesn't have quite that same edge. And yet, there is so much negativity in the public debate around the election. And the same applies to the way that people see politicians. In the past, people always made jokes about politicians being dodgy. And if you look at opinion polls, even 50 years ago, people thought politicians were a bunch of crooks. But they somehow combined it with a certain sort of deference. And I think what's changed is that Britain is very uncomfortable with that kind of attitude towards anybody anymore. I think people are very keen to detect when they feel that somebody's pulling one over them. And I think politicians, particularly in Britain, are very, very vulnerable to this. Something like 30% of the cabinet went to private school, but something like 70% of judges went to private school, 60% of army officers went to private school. In a way, what people want from politicians is different from what they want from other professions. It's more important, I think, for people to feel that the politicians are representative of society as a whole than they perhaps want to feel with an army officer, or even potentially a journalist, or an actor, or a sportsman.
Isabel Hardman, assistant editor of The Spectator magazine.
There are many, many, proportionally more people from private schools within Parliament. And there are, within the general population, I think it's only 7% of people are educated at private schools, and it varies from party to party, but it's probably more around a third to a half within Parliament have come from private schools, which really isn't good enough, actually. And that may be as a result of the failure of the education system. It's also probably to do with social networks, where people know one another and are more likely to be elected to Parliament because of who they know. And that is a problem.
I'm, suppose, divided on what a cabinet should look like. Part of me feels that what matters is how good the cabinet is, how good their ideas are. But I also understand why people are concerned that the cabinet should feel representative.
8th of May, the election count, Penrith.
About 1:15 in the morning now. And we're in the Eden Leisure Centre. We're looking at two large nets with medicine balls stuck in the top of them, strip lights over our head, a whole series of white plastic tables with probably 50 counting agents busily separating district council from other boxes. And we're waiting for the result, which could come anywhere between 2 and 4 in the morning. One thing that's really, really important to me here, which I'm really worried about and anxious about, is that this is, in a sense, my report card. I'm standing here, and I know, because I've watched them, every other candidate saying they think they have significantly reduced my majority. And we shall see.
Roderick James Nugent Stewart, Conservative Party, 26,202.
So the majority here, I think, has been for nearly 55 years since the constituency was created, about 12,000. and in a single term we've taken it up to 20,000. So that's really wonderful. But it's nothing to be complacent about. I mean, again, you know, tonight, people in Scotland with majorities of 23,000 have lost their seats. British politics is changing very quickly.
John Stevenson also won back his seat in the neighbouring constituency of Carlisle.
The Conservatives, to many people's surprise, won an outright majority at the general election. And with that victory, Rory received the news that he'd been offered the job of Parliamentary Under-Secretary of State at the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. And he was absolutely delighted, as anyone who's ambitious to be in government would be. It's a fascinating department for him because he's in a rural constituency. It's very close to a lot of the concerns of his constituents, so it's a very good ministry to be in. I think he sees his career to date as being training for governing, and I think in that sense it's a very, very good and interesting post for him.
Rory's promotion to DEFRA was quite surprising on a number of levels. One is that actually the influence of a select committee chair is much more powerful than that of a junior minister.
I'm very frustrated that Rory left the chairmanship of the Defence Select Committee. I think most of the other members of the committee were.
Madeleine Moon, Labour MP for Bridge End and member of the Defence Select Committee.
Because he was doing a good job, but he's been offered a junior post in the government office, and if he wants to climb up through Parliament, that's the way you go.
Rory is in politics for the long term. He's been given a very important job to do, and I think he's very passionate about doing that particular job. Doesn't mean he's forgotten about his views, for example, on defence policy or foreign policy, on where defence spending should be, on what Britain's role in the world should be. But one has to be strategic in any line of work or any kind of job. You've got to take a sort of long-term view about these things. I'm sure that's what he's doing.
It's very difficult to say how far Rory will go. I don't know how soon he will become bored and frustrated by the limitations of having to take other people with him, of having to really build consensus amongst those who he will need to support him. To rise, you also need powerful political friends. And I don't know that Rory has powerful political friends. A minister always has to side with and vote with the government, no matter how much they totally disagree with it. I don't know how he's going to be able to cope with that.
Archive on 4, MP for Penrith and the Border, was produced by Isabel Sutton. It was a Just Radio production for BBC Radio 4.